Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. The Signalman by Charles Dickens. Hello, below there! When he heard a voice thus calling to him, he was standing at the door of his box with a flag in his hand furled round its short pole. One would have thought, considering the nature of the ground, that he could not have doubted from what quarter the voice came, but instead of looking up to where I stood on the top of the steep cutting nearly over his head, he turned himself about and looked down the line. There was something remarkable in his manner of doing so, though I could not have said for my life what. But I know it was remarkable enough to attract my notice, even though his figure was foreshortened and shadowed down in the deep trench, and mine was high above him, so steeped in the glow of an angry sunset, that I had shaded my eyes with my hand before I saw him at all. "Hello, below!" From looking down the line, he turned himself about again, and raising his eyes, saw my figure high above him. "Is there any path by which I can come down and speak to you?" He looked up at me without replying, and I looked down at him without pressing him too soon with a repetition of my idle question. Just then there came a vague vibration in the earth and air, quickly changing into a violent pulsation, and an oncoming rush that caused me to start back, as though it had forced to draw me down. When such vapour as rose to my height from this rapid train had passed me and was skimming away over the landscape, I looked down again and saw him refurling the flag he had shown while the train went by. I repeated my inquiry. After a pause during which he seemed to regard me with fixed attention, he motioned with his rolled-up flag toward a point on my level, some 200 or 300 yards distant. I called down to him, "All right," and made for that point. There, by dint of looking closely about me, I found a rough zigzag descending path notched out, which I followed. The cutting was extremely deep and unusually precipitate. It was made through a clammy stone that became oozier and wetter as I went down. For these reasons, I found the way long enough to give me time to recall a singular air of reluctance or compulsion with which he had pointed out the path. When I came down low enough upon the zigzag descent to see him again, I saw that he was standing between the rails on the way by which the train had lately passed. In an attitude as if he were waiting for me to appear, he had his left hand at his chin, and that left elbow rested on his right hand, crossed over his breast. His attitude was one of such expectation and watchfulness that I stopped a moment, wondering at it. I resumed my downward way and, stepping out upon the level of the railroad and drawing nearer to him, saw that he was a dark, sallow man, with a dark beard and rather heavy eyebrows. His post was as solitary and dismal a place as ever I saw. On either side, a dripping wet wall of jagged stone, excluding all view but a strip of sky. The perspective one way, only a crooked prolongation of this great dungeon. The shorter perspective in the other direction, terminating in a gloomy red light, and the gloomier entrance to a black tunnel, in whose massive architecture there was a barbarous, depressing, and forbidding air. So little sunlight ever found its way to this spot that it had an earthy, deadly smell, and so much cold wind rushed through it that it struck chill to me, as if I had left the natural world. Before he stirred, I was near enough to him to have touched him. Not even then, removing his eyes from mine, he stepped back one step and lifted his hand. "This was a lonesome post to occupy," I said, and it had riveted my attention when I looked down from up yonder. A visitor was a rarity, I should suppose. Not an unwelcome rarity, I hoped. In me, he merely saw a man who had been shut up within narrow limits all his life, and who, being at last set free, had a newly awakened interest in these great works. To such purpose I spoke to him, but I am far from sure of the terms I used, for besides that I am not happy in opening any conversation, there was something in the man that daunted me. He directed a most curious look toward the red light near the tunnel's mouth, and looked all about it as if something were missing from it, and then looked at me. "That light was part of his charge, was it not?" He answered in a low voice, "Don't you know it is?" The monstrous thought came into my mind as I perused the fixed eyes and the saturnine face, that this was a spirit, not a man. I have speculated since whether there may have been infection in his mind. In my turn, I stepped back, but in making the action, I detected in his eyes some latent fear of me. This put the monstrous thought to flight. "You look at me," I said, forcing a smile, "as if you had a dread of me." "I was doubtful," he returned, "whether I had seen you before." "Where?" He pointed to the red light he had looked at. "There?" I said. Intently watchful of me, he replied, but without sound, "Yes." "My good fellow, what should I do there? However, be that as it may, I never was there, you may swear." "I think I may," he rejoined. "Yes, I am sure I may." His manner cleared like my own. He replied to my remarks with readiness and in well-chosen words. Had he much to do there? Yes. That was to say, he had enough responsibility to bear, but exactness and watchfulness were what were required of him, and of actual work, manual labor, he had next to none. To change that signal, to trim those lights, and to turn this iron handle now and then was all he had to do under that head. Regarding those many long and lonely hours of which I seemed to make so much, he could only say that the routine of his life had shaped itself into that form, and he had grown used to it. He had taught himself a language down there, if only to know it by sight and to have formed his own crude ideas of its pronunciation could be called learning it. He had also worked at fractions and decimals and tried a little algebra, but he was, and had been as a boy, a poor hand at figures. Was it necessary for him, when on duty, always to remain in that channel of damp air? And could he never rise into the sunshine from between those high stone walls? Why, that depended upon times and circumstances. Under some conditions, there would be less upon the line than under others. And the same held good as to certain hours of the day and night. In bright weather, he did choose occasions for getting a little above these lower shadows. But being at all times liable to be called by his electric bell, and at such times listening for it with redoubled anxiety, the relief was less than I would suppose. He took me into his box, where there was a fire, a desk for an official book in which he had to make certain entries, a telegraphic instrument with its dial face and needles, and the little bell of which he had spoken. On my trusting that he would excuse the remark that he had been well educated, and I hoped I might say without offence, perhaps educated above that station, he observed what instances of slight incongruity in such wise would rarely be found wanting among large bodies of men, that he had heard it was so in workhouses, in the police force, even in that last desperate resource, the army, and that he knew it was so, more or less, in any great railway staff. He had been, when young, if I could believe it, sitting in that hut, he scarcely could, a student of natural philosophy, and had attended lectures. But he had run wild, misused his opportunities, gone down, and never risen again. He had no complaint to offer about that. He had made his bed and he lay upon it. It was far too late to make another. "All that I have here condensed," he said in a quiet manner, with his grave dark regards divided between me and the fire. He threw in the word sir from time to time, and especially when he referred to his youth, as though to request me to understand that he claimed to be nothing but what I found him. He was several times interrupted by the little bell, and had to read off messages and send replies. Once he had to stand without the door and display a flag as a train passed, and to make some verbal communication with the driver. In the discharge of his duties, I observed him to be remarkably exact and vigilant, breaking off his discourse at a syllable and remaining silent until what he had to do was done. In a word, I should have set this man down as one of the safest of men to be employed in that capacity, but for the circumstances that while he was speaking to me, he twice broke off with a fallen colour, turned his face towards the little bell when it did not ring, opened the door of the hut, which was kept shut to exclude the unhealthy damp, and looked out towards the red light near the mouth of the tunnel. On both those occasions, he came back to the fire with the inexplicable air upon him which I had remarked, without being able to define, when we were so far asunder. Said I, when I rose to leave him, "You almost make me think that I have met with a contented man." I am afraid I must acknowledge that I said it to lead him on. "I believe I used to be so," he rejoined, in the low voice in which he had first spoken. "But I am troubled, sir. I am troubled." He would have recalled the words if he could. He had said them, however, and I took them up quickly. "With what? What is your trouble?" "It is very difficult to impart, sir. It is very, very difficult to speak of. If ever you make me another visit, I will try to tell you." "But I expressly intend to make you another visit. Say, when shall it be?" "I go off early in the morning, and I shall be on again at 10 tomorrow night, sir." "I will come at 11. He thanked me and went out the door with me. "I'll show my white light, sir," he said in his peculiar low voice, "till you have found the way up. When you have found it, don't call out, and when you're at the top, don't call out." His manner seemed to make the very place strike colder to me, but I said no more than "very well." "And when you come down tomorrow night, don't call out. Let me ask you a parting question. What made you cry, 'Hello, below there,' tonight?" "Heaven knows," said I. "I cried something to that effect." "Not to that effect, sir. Those were the very words. I know them well."
"Admit, those were the very words. I said them, no doubt, because I saw you below."
"For no other reason?"
"What other reason could I possibly have?"
"You had no feeling they were conveyed to you in any supernatural way?"
"No." He wished me good night and held up his light. I walked by the side of the down line of rails with a very disagreeable sensation of a train coming behind me until I found the path. It was easier to mount than to descend, and I got back to my inn without any adventure. Punctual to my appointment, I placed my foot on the first notch of the zigzag next night as the distant clocks were striking 11. He was calling for me at the bottom with his light on. "I have not called out," I said, when we came close together. "May I speak now?"
"By all means, sir."
"Good night, then, and here's my hand."
"Good night, sir, and here's mine."
With that, we walked side by side to his box, entered it, closed the door, and sat down by the fire.
"I have made up my mind, sir," he began, bending forward as soon as we were seated, and speaking in a tone but a little above a whisper, "that you shall not have to ask me twice what troubles me. I took you for someone else yesterday evening. That troubles me."
"That mistake?"
"No, that someone else."
"Who is it?"
"I don't know."
"Like me?"
"I don't know. I never saw the face. The left arm is across the face and the right arm is waved, violently waved this way." I followed his action with my eyes, and it was the action of an arm gesticulating with the utmost passion and vehemence, "For God's sake, clear the way."
"One moonlight night," said the man, "I was sitting here,
When I heard a voice cry, "Hello, below there," I started up, looked from that door, and saw this someone else standing by the red light near the tunnel, waving as I just now showed you. The voice seemed hoarse with shouting and cried, "Look out, look out," and then again, "Hello, below there, look out." I caught up my lamp, turned it on red, and ran towards the figure, calling, "What's wrong? What has happened? Where?" It stood just outside the blackness of the tunnel. I advanced so close upon it that I wondered at its keeping its sleeve across its eyes. I ran right up at it, and had my hand stretched out to pull the sleeve away when it was gone. "Into the tunnel?" said I. "No." I ran on into the tunnel 500 yards. I stopped and held my lamp above my head and saw the figures of the measured distance, and saw the wet stains stealing down the walls and trickling through the arch. I ran out again, faster than I had run in, for I had a mortal abhorrence of the place upon me, and I looked all around the red light with my own red light, and I went up the iron ladder to the gallery atop of it, and I came down again, and ran back here. I telegraphed both ways, "An alarm has been given, is anything wrong?" The answer came back both ways, "All well." Resisting the slow touch of a frozen finger tracing out my spine, I showed him how that this figure must be a deception of his sense of sight, and how that figures originating in disease of the delicate nerves that minister to the functions of the eye were known to have often troubled patients, some of whom had become conscious of the nature of their affliction and had even proved it by experiments upon themselves. "As to an imaginary cry," said I, "do but listen for a moment to the wind in this unnatural valley while we speak so low, and to the wild harp it makes of the telegraph wires." "That was all very well," he returned, after we had sat listening for a while, "and he ought to know something of the wind and the wires, he who so often passed long winter nights there, alone and watching. But he would beg to remark that he had not finished." I asked his pardon, and he slowly added these words, touching my arm. "Within 6 hours after the appearance, the memorable accident on this line happened, and within 10 hours, the dead and wounded were brought along through the tunnel over the spot where the figure had stood." A disagreeable shudder crept over me, but I did my best against it. "It was not to be denied," I rejoined, "that this was a remarkable coincidence, calculated deeply to impress his mind. But it was unquestionable that remarkable coincidences did continually occur, and they must be taken into account in dealing with such a subject. Though, to be sure, I must admit," I added, for I thought I saw that he was going to bring the objection to bear upon me, "men of common sense did not allow much for coincidences in making the ordinary calculations of life." He again begged to remark that he had not finished. I again begged his pardon for being betrayed into interruptions. "This," he said, again laying his hand upon my arm and glancing over his shoulder with his hollow eyes, "was just a year ago. 6 or 7 months passed, and I had recovered from the surprise and shock, when one morning as the day was breaking, I, standing at the door, looked toward the red light, and saw the spectre again." He stopped, with a fixed look at me. "Did it cry out?" "No, it was silent." "Did it wave its arm?" "No, it leaned against the shaft of the light with both hands before the face, like this." Once more I followed his action with my eyes. It was an action of mourning. I have seen such an attitude in stone figures on tombs.
"Did you go up to it?"
"I came in and sat down, partly to collect my thoughts, partly because it had turned me faint. When I went to the door again, daylight was above me and the ghost was gone."
"But nothing followed? Nothing came of this?" He touched me on the arm with his forefinger twice or thrice, giving a ghastly nod each time.
"That very day, as a train came out of the tunnel, I noticed at the carriage window on my side what looked like a confusion of hands and heads, and something waved. I saw it just in time to signal the driver stop. He shut off and put his brake on, but the train drifted past here 150 yards or more. I ran after it, and as I went along heard terrible screams and cries. A beautiful young lady had died instantaneously in one of the compartments, and was brought in here and laid down on this floor between us. Involuntarily, I pushed my chair back as I looked from the boards at which he pointed to himself. "True, sir. True. Precisely as it happened, so I tell it you." I could think of nothing to say to any purpose, and my mouth was very dry. The wind and the wires took up the story with a long, lamenting wail. He resumed. "Now, sir, mark this and judge how my mind is troubled. The spectre came back a week ago. Ever since, it has been there now and again by fits and starts."
"At the light?"
"At the danger light."
"What does it seem to do?"
He repeated, if possible, with increased passion and vehemence, that former gesticulation of, "For God's sake, clear the way." Then he went on, "I have no peace or rest for it. It calls to me, for many minutes together, in an agonized manner. Below there, look out, look out. It stands waving to me. It rings my little bell."
I caught at that.
"Did it ring your bell yesterday evening when I was here, and you went to the door?"
"Twice."
"Why, see," said I, "how your imagination misleads you. My eyes were on the bell, and my ears were open to the bell. And if I am a living man, it did not ring at those times. No, nor at any other time except when it was rung in the natural course of physical things by the station communicating with you."
He shook his head. "I have never made a mistake as to that yet, sir. I have never confused the spectre's ring with the man's. The ghost's ring is a strange vibration in the bell that it derives from nothing else, and I have not asserted that the bell stirs to the eye. I don't wonder that you failed to hear it, but I heard it."
"And did the spectre seem to be there when you looked out?"
"It was there."
"Both times?"
he repeated firmly.
"Both times."
"Will you come to the door with me and look for it now?"
He bit his underlip as though he were somewhat unwilling, but arose. I opened the door and stood on the step while he stood in the doorway. There was the danger light. There was the dismal mouth of the tunnel. There were the high wet stone walls of the cutting. There were the stars above them.
"Do you see it?" I asked him, taking particular note of his face. His eyes were prominent and strained, but not very much more so, perhaps, than my own had been when I had directed them earnestly towards the same spot.
"No," he answered, "it's not there."
"Agreed," said I.
We went in again, shut the door, and resumed our seats. I was thinking how best to improve this advantage, if it might be called one, when he took up the conversation in such a matter-of-course way, so assuming that there could be no serious question of fact between us, that I felt myself placed in the weakest of positions. "By this time you will fully understand, sir," he said, "that what troubles me so dreadfully is the question, what does the spectre mean?"
I was not sure, I told him, that I did fully understand.
"What is its warning against?" he said, ruminating with his eyes on the fire, and only by times turning them on me. "What is the danger? Where is the danger? There is danger of a hanging, somewhere on the line. Some dreadful calamity will happen. It's not to be doubted this third time after what's gone before. But surely this is a cruel haunting of me. What can I do?"
He pulled out his handkerchief and wiped the drops from his heated forehead.
"If I telegraph danger on either side of me or on both, I can give no reason for it," he went on, wiping the palms of his hands. "I should get into trouble and do no good. They would think I was mad. This is the way it would work. Message, danger, take care. Answer, what danger, where? Message, don't know, but for God's sake, take care. They would displace me. What else could they do?"
His pain of mind was most pitiable to see,
It was the mental torture of a conscientious man, oppressed beyond endurance by an unintelligible responsibility involving life. When it first stood under the danger light, he went on, pulling his dark hair back from his head and drawing his hands outward across and across his temples in an extremity of feverish distress. Why not tell me where that accident was to happen? If it must happen, why not tell me how it could be averted? If it could have been averted. When on its second coming it hid its face, why not tell me instead she is going to die? Let them keep her at home. If it came on those two occasions only to show me that its warnings were true, and so to prepare me for the third, why not warn me plainly now? And I, Lord help me, a mere poor signalman on this solitary station. Why not go to somebody with credit to be believed and power to act? When I saw him in this state, I saw that for the poor man's sake, as well as for the public safety, what I had to do for the time was to compose his mind. Therefore, setting aside all question of reality or unreality between us, I represented to him that whoever thoroughly discharged his duty must do well, and that at least it was his comfort that he understood his duty, though he did not understand these confounding appearances. In this effort, I succeeded far better than in the attempt to reason him out of his conviction. He became calm. The occupations incidental to his post as the night advanced began to make larger demands on his attention, and I left him at 2 in the morning. I had offered to stay through the night, but he would not hear of it. That I more than once looked back at the red light as I ascended the pathway, that I did not like the red light, and that I should have slept but poorly if my bed had been under it, I see no reason to conceal. Nor did I like the two sequences of the accident and the dead girl. I see no reason to conceal that either. But what ran most in my thoughts was the consideration how I ought to act, having become the recipient of this disclosure. I had proved the man to be intelligent, vigilant, painstaking, and exact. But how long might he remain so in his state of mind? Though in a subordinate position, still he held a most important trust, and would I, for instance, like to stake my own life on the chances of his continuing to execute it with precision? Unable to overcome a feeling that there would be something treacherous in my communicating what he had told me to his superiors in the company, without first being plain with himself and proposing a middle course to him, I ultimately resolved to offer to accompany him, otherwise keeping his secret for the present, to the wisest medical practitioner we could hear of in those parts, and to take his opinion. A change in his time of duty would come around next night, he had apprised me, and he would be off an hour or two after sunrise, and on again soon after sunset. I had appointed to return accordingly. Next evening was a lovely evening, and I walked out early to enjoy it. The sun was not yet quite down when I had traversed the field path near the top of the deep cutting. I would extend my walk for an hour, I said to myself, half an hour on and half an hour back, and it would then be time to go to my signalman's box. Before pursuing my stroll, I stepped to the brink and mechanically looked down from the point which I had first seen him. I cannot describe the thrill that seized upon me when, close at the mouth of the tunnel, I saw the appearance of a man with his left sleeve across his eyes, passionately waving his right arm. The nameless horror that oppressed me passed in a moment, for in a moment I saw that this appearance of a man was a man indeed, and that there was a little group of other men standing at a short distance to whom he seemed to be rehearsing the gesture he made. The danger light was not yet lighted. Against its shaft, a little low hut, entirely new to me, had been made of some wooden supports and a tarpaulin. It looked no bigger than a bed. With an irresistible sense that something was wrong, with a flashing self-reproachful fear that fatal mischief had come of my leaving the man there and causing no one to be sent to overlook or correct what he did, I descended the notched path with all the speed I could make. "What is the matter?" I asked the men. "A signalman killed this morning, sir." "Not the man belonging to that box?" "Yes, sir." "Not the man I know?" "You will recognize him, sir, if you knew him," said the man who spoke for the others, solemnly uncovering his own head, and raising an end of the tarpaulin, for his face is quite composed.
Oh, how did this happen? How did this happen? I asked, turning from one to another as the hut closed in again.
He was cut down by an engine, sir. No man in England knew his work better, but somehow he was not clear of the outer rail. It was just at broad day. He'd struck the light and had the lamp in his hand. And the engine came out the tunnel, his back was toward her, and she cut him down. That man drove her, and he was showing how it happened.
Show the gentleman, Tom.
The man, who wore a rough, dark dress, stepped back to his former place at the mouth of the tunnel.
Coming round the curve in the tunnel, sir, I saw him at the end, like as if I saw him down a perspective glass. There was no time to check speed, and I knew him to be very careful, as he didn't seem to take heed of the whistle. I shut it off when we were running down upon him, and called to him as loud as I could call.
What did you say?
I said, below there, look out, for God's sake, clear the way.
I started.
Oh, it was a dreadful time, sir. I never left off calling to him. I put this arm before my eyes not to see, and I waved this arm to the last, but it was no use.
Without prolonging the narrative to dwell on any one of its curious circumstances more than on any other, I may, in closing it, point out the coincidence that the warning of the engine driver included not only the words which the unfortunate signalman had repeated to me as haunting him, but also the words which I myself, not he, had attached, and that only in my own mind, to the gesticulation he had imitated.
And that was The Signalman by Charles Dickens. And it is an extra bonus episode of The Great Stories because of the Christmas period that's in it. And I wanted to say ho, 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 and thank you very much on behalf of myself and Pooley. I also wanted to give Pooley the time off and just do this on my own. So it's a sort of all-round gift. But I don't want to shortchange you, and I do want to just talk a little bit about this story because it's very interesting from a number of different perspectives. Some of you may know various bits and bobs about Dickens himself, about his life. Some of you may know a little bit about this story, and you may also be wondering why it is that I picked this particular story for the Christmas special, seeing as I went with O. Henry's The Gift of the Magi for the first year of The Great Stories existence. And then last Christmas I went with The Dead by James Joyce, which is again set at Christmas and quite the classic tale. Well, I'm afraid the sad story is that I had this in my mind for some strange reason, best known to myself, as a Christmas story, and that I committed to it. I was standing in the recording booth wondering when it would be that the Christmas stuff would kick in, and it never did. And I realized then that what I could do is just abandon ship or present this one to you. And actually, because everything's so bloody horrible and scary, I thought we'd have some faux scariness, some fake horror in our lives to distract us, rather perhaps than some kind of saccharine stuff which you can get all you want of on your Netflix or your Amazon Prime or your subscription of choice. So I thought what we'd do is we'd unnerve you in a pleasant campfire ghost story way with this particular story by Charles Dickens. And for those who aren't familiar with Dickens and his background, he was born to a Navy clerk and he grew up in Kent in England. I think he was 10 years old when the family eventually moved to London, which obviously is the site of and the source of many of his tales. His father was thrown into debtor's prison, which was very much a thing at the time in the dystopian world of the past. Yeah. When he left school, he worked in, of all things, a boot blacking warehouse and tried to contribute some money to the household. And he did go back to school for a while, but I think by the time he was 15, he had left and was working as a law clerk, a court reporter. He was a political journalist for a while before devoting himself to the full-time writing career. Most of us know that Dickens was incredibly successful during his own lifetime. Books like Hard Times, Great Expectations, Bleak House, Oliver Twist, and all the rest of them were popular then as they are today. He did also become involved with founding a theatre company. He had a magazine called All the Year Round. He had a marriage which yielded 10 children and a lot of unhappiness for himself by all accounts. And he died in 1870. Now, context for this particular story, which is quite interesting, I wanted to fill you in on, was that, of course, we're talking now about, you know, the Victorian era when Dickens was writing. And obviously, we're flat out Industrial Revolution at that time. Industrialization was the thing. It was, if you like, the birth of the world in which we all live today. And if this story doesn't flat out criticize that industrialization or present itself as a critique of technology, you'd have to say that it definitely is somewhat inspired by the human cost of that Industrial Revolution. Now, Dickens himself survived a very serious rail accident, which became known as the Staplehurst rail crash. It occurred on the 9th of June 1865 when his train was derailed. There was apparently, in this particular incident, a signalman with a red flag who was waiting in the tracks to warn the conductor, but yeah, alas, he was standing in the wrong place. The train didn't have time to stop, and it wasn't just him. There were 10 other passengers who died, 40 wounded. Dickens himself, in quite heroic fashion, tried to help some of his fellow passengers, but also witnessed some deaths as he did so. Now, as you might imagine, this had a deep impact on him. I think it stopped him from at least voluntarily going towards rail travel thereafter. But it's not just that one accident which is probably feeding into the signalman. In the story, one of the questions is around the responsibility that the signalman himself has for the accidents that occur. And there's the introduction of several interesting themes, which I'm going to go on and talk about in a second. On the back of that, the idea of the supernatural, the idea of personal responsibility, the idea of solitude, loneliness, isolation, the alienation brought about by industrialization. All of these things are here, but there's also another rail crash which Dickens's readers at the time would have been thinking of as they read The Signalman, because in 1861, the Clayton Tunnel rail crash occurred, and in this one, 23 passengers were killed, 176 wounded. It was a direct head-on collision between two trains, and obviously, although the man himself wasn't involved with this one, it was a very, very well-known disaster. And obviously those reading his stories would have been very familiar with it. It would have been part of the zeitgeist, especially and specifically because at the heart of this accident was a confused signalman who caused this Clayton Tunnel crash, when basically he misread a signal and gave the all clear to a train which was not all clear. And we know what happened as a result, as I've just explained to you. So this is the historical context for the story. And that's one thing, and it's interesting, absolutely. I was fascinated. I read this story years ago in college in a book of ghost stories, but I hadn't revisited it since. And I had mixed it up with a couple of M.R. James stories, which I'd considered as well at one point for the great stories. And so I had no notion that Dickens had this biographical input into the story. That really added a level of fascination for me. But we need to look a little bit at what it is he's trying to get at here in this story. I mean, what is the story about as such? And look, you can pull these things apart and read whatever you want into them, but I don't think there's any doubt but that we're looking at the ideas of fear, like I said before, isolation, alienation, especially in that the poor signalman's really, really grim working conditions. I mean, the author lays it on thick. It's not just physically oppressive, but it's psychologically oppressive as well. And therefore, you have to ask yourself the obvious question about madness too. We have to then ask ourselves the question that the narrator asks around how much can this man be trusted or respected. It's very interesting, I think, that when the report of the accident is being given and the signalman is dead, that the engine driver talks and the other his other colleague talks about how no man knew his job better than this one guy. They obviously had respect for this guy. I don't know if it's a dying out thing. I really don't. But I do know that when I was a younger man, there was a certain pride in what you did that I associated very much with a certain working class to lower middle class aspect of English society, where people felt they had a role, they took great pride in it, it defined them. And I think you can see in this story that the signalman is that guy. But of course, then also we have to admit that there is a hint and a suggestion of a life that was also available to this guy. And it's why I chose a slightly plummier voice for this guy, because he is a man of learning. He is a man who seems, I think, marooned where he is. He doesn't seem to be necessarily suited to his role, because the type of chap I was talking about, and again, it's with apologies, because obviously an awful lot of these jobs in a very patriarchal society are dominated by men, or exclusively occupied by men, in case it seems as if I'm not acknowledging that. But it seems as if he doesn't really fit with great ease into that category I was talking about before. This guy seems to have at least aspirations towards something a little bit loftier. The fact that he tries to learn a language, the fact that he goes at mathematics and algebra when he knows that he's not naturally gifted at it, that leads me to believe that this is a man who, he's of intellect, he has aspirations at least. And so when he is this man, this responsible, dogged, determined, he realizes he's blown his opportunity, you know, he's made his bed, as he says, he's gonna lie in it. This guy who seems to be a moral man, when he decides to inform his new friend, this curious narrator character, about his supernatural experiences, I believe you have to take that seriously. And even though the narrator, who is obviously a scientific materialist, he is a man of the world, for want of a better expression, a man of his time, a man who believes in the science, well, even he is unnerved spectacularly on a regular basis, as we are informed by the words of the story, by the details of the signalman's story. And the story ends itself with the narrator's account of the fact there are still some desperately unnerving details of the signalman's story, which would give the lie to the fact that this was some just strung out, lonely man experiencing some sort of psychotic break or dissociation or any other mental complaint or ailment. No, it would appear that the overall preponderance of the evidence in this story suggests that actually there's quite something to this supernatural aspect. It's why it works as a ghost story, because it's got at least as much heft behind it, especially because of all the coincidental stuff that goes right into the final paragraph, the wording of the utterances, the fact that it had only been in the narrator's head. How the hell could that be the actual wording? I love that. And for me, that leans into Dickens suggesting or leaning us towards the idea of a supernatural interpretation of this story, which, you know, for my money is exactly where I want to go with all these kind of things. You'll know me of old if you've listened to enough of these shows. For a man who leans into technology with gusto, I'm also incredibly wary of, you know, anything that even vaguely resembles scientism or overt extreme materialist scientism. I can't abide that. And so this is a story which for me found its natural home between my ears, and I thought I'd share it with you. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. I can't tell you how much of a pleasure it is to continue doing this show. I feel blessed that we have people who are supporting the show on a monthly basis. I hope that maybe some of you who are listening will consider doing this, or at least a one-off donation. I want to explain to you how I see this. I consider this to be ultimately a value for value thing. The subscription thing offers me some sort of hope of keeping this alive. But the donations, in whatever form they occur, I just want you to think of them as value for what you received. So I hope to provide you with value, and then perhaps you can provide me with value back. It's not a new model. It's a model that's been well established by some very successful podcasts in the past. And the best thing about it is that it is sustainable going forward. It does not rely on advertising. It does not rely on me pimping myself out to sell mattresses to you. It just means I will do my damnedest to give you a good product, and maybe you might consider giving me something back for it. If that sounds like something that might be of interest to you, I'd appreciate it greatly if you would go to greatstoriespod.com and consider becoming a sustaining producer or donating on a one-off basis. If in the times that's in it, you're not able to do that, I completely get it. I genuinely do. Please consider just retweeting, passing it on by word of mouth, letting people know if you enjoyed it and why you enjoyed it. I'd appreciate that immensely. You're lovely folks, all of you, especially those of you who keep the lights on here at Great Stories Towers. You're appreciated immensely. I want you to know that, and I hope every one of you listening has a lovely holiday period.